This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Two new reports from the state legislature and the Boston Globe lay responsibility at the feet of Governor Charlie Baker and his administration for conditions that helped lead to 76 COVID-19 deaths at the Holyoke Soldiers Home last year. One report from a joint legislative committee says Baker and his top deputies knew the facility was poorly run and critically understaffed well before the pandemic and failed to act. The other, a bombshell investigation by the Boston Globe's Spotlight team, also ties Baker and Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters directly to the hiring and oversight of Bennett Walsh. Walsh was superintendent of the home and now faces criminal charges. Here to discuss are the chairs of the report from the Special Joint Oversight Committee, State Representative Linda Dean Campbell and State Senator Michael Rush. Thanks to the two of you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
So let me start, Senator Rush, by asking you, what did you find in the report and what surprised you?
Well, Representative Campbell and I and our team on our committee really did a deep dive into the information that was present to us, specifically dealing with everything from COVID moving forward, what happened in those critical days leading up to this horrendous tragedy at the Soldiers' Home, but also to incorporate much of the history of that and our other Soldiers' Homes into the report as well. So to as a legislative committee, that's what we do. We get to the bottom of it. We get the facts and we put the report together. So that's what we did. We did a very deep dive into the activities that took place throughout this tragedy.
So Representative Campbell, in those findings, does the report place culpability with Governor Baker and his leadership team in the conditions that helped lead to the tragedy at the Soldiers' Home?
Well, I think clearly that we document in our report multiple points of failure, right? There certainly were points of personal leadership and accountability failure at the Holyoke Soldiers' Home, of course, through the superintendent and others as well. And communication, the muddled chain of command, the lack of accountability and responsibility, I think was clearly outlined in the report as it pertains to HHS and the governor's office as well. All of that, I think, had a major impact on creating, if you will, a perfect storm.
Have the two of you spoken with Governor Baker about the report or with top leaders in his administration?
We have not. Let me back that up. I have not spoken. Our vote actually just was finalized within the committee. It was a unanimous vote to release the report to the clerk's office. So we're just at noontime today. We just finished up. But no, I have not spoken to anyone in the administration at this point in time.
State Senator Michael Rush,
No, nor have I. And as the rep just mentioned, we just took our votes noontime. So, and it was, as she mentioned, it was a unanimous vote.
So what were some of the most important findings? I mean, let's, our listeners, you just voted on this. Our listeners almost certainly haven't read it. What are some of the most important findings, State Senator Michael Rush?
Sure. I think, certainly places in perspective. And I think there's a historical aspect that people who are interested in the topic need to have an understanding of. The state currently owns and operates two soldiers or veterans homes. And there have been issues with both of them for many, many years in terms of government structures acting very separate from each other, the veterans who they serve. You know, there's a historical aspect. Some would say that, as the rep called it, the unfortunate perfect storm was 50 years in the making of really two isolated institutions that only served a very small population. And unlike being statewide veterans homes, they really operated as small islands unto themselves in the local areas.
Representative Campbell, there was also the Perlstein report. It came out in June, commissioned by Governor Baker. How different are the findings in your committee's report from what came out in the Perlstein report?
Well, I would say to Senator Rush's very important point, the committee had a two-pronged approach. First, we were tasked with looking at the immediacy of the crises and how it evolved over a short period of time. We received testimony from Attorney Perlstein regarding those, immediate findings and immediate actions or lack of actions that were taken as the crisis unfolded during those that short period of time. But the committee came to an immediate conclusion that the Perlstein report generated more questions than answers. And also the testimony that we received out in Holyoke from family members and staff, we were immediately aware that we had to do a much deeper dive, that we could read about the actions that transpired within a short amount of time, but the Perlstein report laid that out about the how, and then the committee went to work to find out the why. And that's that testimony led us to dig a lot deeper.
So, Representative Campbell, what do you think should have been done differently in those early days?
Well, I think one of the obvious conclusions that many are reaching is that I think it's well documented that the toxic leadership or and lack of leadership on the part of Superintendent Bennett Walsh is clearly documented through testimony that we received. I think what's also clearly documented is there were substantial questions about his qualifications for the position, right? And there is we do a very deep dive on staffing issues that had been in place, staffing shortages that had been in place over a period of years, really, at the soldiers' home. So in order for these things to change, there has to be change in some governance structures, and I think particularly along the lines of chain of command and who reports to whom and who's going to be held accountable and responsible, for communicating to a specific individual who can take actions to address situations in the immediacy. And so I think those governing structures that we look to establish that chain of command and collaboration between both, soldiers' homes is so critical.
And, so let's stay with that chain of, excuse me for interrupting, I'm mindful that we have limited time. There are a couple other questions I want to get in. Yeah. Staying with that chain of command, you just talked about Superintendent Bennett Walsh. We also know that Secretary of Veterans Services Francisco Llerena resigned back in June after the Perlstein report came out. Governor Baker and Secretary Sutter's laid responsibility at their feet. Walsh is under criminal investigation, but the Globe investigation details a web of political connections that suggest Walsh was hired for political reasons, that there was management chain there. Based on the report and the work done by the Globe, Senator, do you believe that Secretary Francisco Llerena was made a scapegoat in this situation?
Well, one of the issues that we address in the report and one of the findings we have, and legislation that has been filed in the past by several of us, has said that the almost 400,000 veterans who live in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts deserve to have the Secretary of Veterans Affairs as a full cabinet secretary. People are very confused. The Secretary of Department of Veterans Affairs in Massachusetts is a commissioner who reports to the Secretary of HHS. It is an honorary title. Our veteran secretary does not sit at the table. Representative Campbell and I are both veterans, and we have called on this governor and past administrations to put the Secretary of Veterans Affairs at the cabinet. The veterans in the state deserve it so that their voices are being heard directly to whoever occupies that corner office.
as veterans, are the two of you angry?
I think certainly I'm angry in the sense that I believe that this tragedy was primarily avoidable. I think when you look at all the evidence that we present in our report, you can see that it was avoidable. If you know, there had been, if action had been taken prior to and regarding the you know, the toxicity of Bennett Walsh's leadership, that had been raised numerous times, right? Up to HHS. I think when you look at all of those points of information and the inability of Francisco, former Secretary Francisco Llerena, to be able to communicate clearly and effectively up the chain of command, those things were certainly preventable. And I think that that's where my, I think the sadness of it comes to play. Certainly there would have been some COVID-related deaths. There's no doubt, right? But the extent to which the leadership decisions that were made at the time were so such an antithesis to, you know, infection management, clearly many of the deaths could have been prevented. And that's, I think, a sad fact.
State Representative Linda Dean Campbell there alongside State Senator Michael Rush. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So listening to that conversation was WBUR's Miriam Wasser, who's been reporting on the Holyoke Soldiers Home for the past year. Miriam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, happy to be here.
So Miriam, let me just start with your reactions to what we just heard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ways that they laid out the differences between their report and the Pearlstein report was pretty accurate, right? The Pearlstein report really focused on kind of what specifically happened in the days and the weeks and months leading up to the outbreak, while this legislative report looked a bit more at structural and systemic problems. And the Pearlstein report, you know, placed most of the blame, as you noted, on Francisco Llerena and Bennett Walsh. And this report, which comes very shortly after the Globe Spotlight piece, says that the Baker administration does deserve some of the blame. I was interested to hear, though, that neither of your previous guests specifically answered the question about whether Llerena was scapegoated. To me, that's kind of the big question out there.
So there are major revelations in these two reports, as you say, mm-hmm. Miriam, coming out pretty close together, that at least suggest that Baker and Sutters knew more about the problems at the home and knew them earlier than they have let on. Were there earlier indications, clues, that this was the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the earliest days of my reporting into this last spring, you know, we were hearing from employees on the ground that the Baker administration wasn't being honest about what they knew and when they knew it. You know, as you might recall, Baker and Sutters stood at a press conference and said they first heard that there was any problem at the soldiers' home around 9 p.m. on Sunday, March 29th. And they said they learned that from former Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. You know, that's not true. And we published a story last summer that showed that Sutters knew about the problem at least 24 hours earlier. We got phone records from the top union official that represents a lot of the staff there, you know, and it showed that she called Sutters the day before and spoke with her. Other big problems like some of the staffing issues and Walsh's management problems, those things were definitely known by Sutters and by others in the administration. And I've talked to a lot of people who feel like the Baker administration really mishandled this and then tried to deflect some blame.
Have you heard from anyone at the soldiers' home since these two reports came out, Miriam?
Yeah, I actually just got off the phone pretty recently with Corey Bombrady, who's the union rep for many of the staff at the facility. And I mean, he told me, you know, quote, this new report is not really telling us anything that we didn't already know. It's just putting a lot of things into writing. And he says, you know, on the Llerena question, he thinks that he definitely made a couple of bad decisions. But at the end of the day, as far as he's concerned, and I guess as far as a lot of the staff are concerned, Llerena took the fall for the state and he was kind of scapegoated.
The two reports, to be clear, suggest that there was more communication he was attempting to send upward than it would have seemed early on, correct?
Yeah. So sorry, to clarify, I guess there's two different things. One would be, you know, that the Perlstein report, that first report, suggested that Urena didn't escalate a request by Walsh to call in the National Guard. Email documents show that that's not true. He forwarded it on within 6 minutes. And then there were also allegations sort of that he didn't take seriously the leadership problems that and anger management problems of Bennett Walsh, when in fact, you know, Urena's own testimony is now showing that he was totally out of the loop on that and that Secretary Sutter's actually handled most of those things.
So in our last 30 seconds or so, Miriam, mm-hmm. you know, you just said that you heard somebody say, this is not a surprise in this report. You said we knew things back in June. So will these reports create an accountability moment, or is this just formal documentation of what we already knew?
I think this is, you know, not necessarily a great answer, but I think it's just we're going to have to wait and see. You know, I mean, there's still a lot of these early systemic problems that were identified in both of these reports. Those things are still playing out on the ground. There's still a severe lack of staffing. When I just talked to the union rep, he said, you know, they're really struggling to hire people. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of calls in the last 24 hours for Secretary Sutter's and Governor Baker to testify explicitly on what came out in the Globe piece and then in this most recent legislative report. So, you know, I think we have to wait and see.
All right. WBUR reporter Miriam Wasser. Miriam, thanks.
Thank you.
Cambridge-based Moderna says its coronavirus vaccine is effective for 12 to 17-year-olds. The company is now going to seek FDA authorization for emergency use with that age group. And if authorized, it would become available for kids 12 and older alongside the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Now, meanwhile, almost 3.5 million Massachusetts residents are now fully vaccinated. That's close to 50% of the state. And this weekend, the Commonwealth's last COVID-19 restrictions lift in most settings. So, listeners, it's Tuesday. You know what to do. It's time to ask the doctors. Call with your coronavirus questions, your reopening questions, your vaccine and mask questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this week, Dr. Shira Daron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Daron, welcome back.
Great to be back.
Dr. Pierre, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So, Dr. Pierre, I'll start with you and this Moderna news. Based on a clinical trial that enrolled almost 4,000 folks between the ages of 12 and 17, we get this information. No cases of symptomatic COVID-19 in those vaccinated. 100% is a pretty full number. So how should we absorb and think about those results?
You know, I think these results are very similar to what we were seeing in the Pfizer trial for 12 to 16-year-olds, in that the vaccine is highly effective and very safe for kids of this age group. And, you know, similar to what we saw with Pfizer and Moderna in the clinical trials for adults, we know that this is an excellent number. What we will actually see in the real-world setting will probably be a little less than 100% effective, but even still, we know that in the real-world setting, very few people who are fully vaccinated are experiencing infection and sincerely, you know, very low numbers of severe complications or hospitalizations or death. So this is all incredibly good news in the real world. Will the efficacy be 100% for either the Pfizer or the Moderna? Probably not. Probably it'll be a little bit less. But even still, we see that there is an incredible response that kids of this age group are making to the vaccine. There's a really great immune response. And so that gives us a real amount of confidence when it comes to thinking about classroom settings, summer camp, going on vacation with the family.
So, Dr. Daron, I want to stay with that for a minute. You know, breakthrough cases get reported. So we hear about multiple members of the New York Yankees, for example, experiencing breakthrough cases after vaccination. I think it makes it hard for the layperson to get a sense for just how effective in the real world these vaccines are. Now, Dr. Pierre just made some comments about that, but how do we put into perspective when we do hear about breakthrough cases in news stories?
It's true. breakthrough cases are happening. That is what we expected. I'm seeing them almost every day, but almost every breakthrough case I see is asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. That's what we wanted. We wanted to, some people call it defang the virus. We wanted to turn this virus into a nuisance, a common cold, nothing to be worried about.
How hard will it be for people, Dr. Pierre, to take something we have been conditioned to be so afraid of for so long and rethink of it as a nuisance?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of mental adjustment there for so many things. The mask mandate, thinking about, you know, what it means when we see COVID positivity numbers or spikes after holiday weekends and what that actually translates to in the burden of disease. I think it's going to be a process, to be honest. We're going to be concerned for a while, you know, with each variant that we hear about. And the real test will be how we do, you know, in our communities, in our city, in the state, and in the country, in withstanding the effects of those rises and falls in cases. So I really do think, I don't have a great answer, but I think it's going to be time. I think it's going to be what we see in our families, what we see when we are back to in-person schooling fully, and how we do really just to start after this holiday weekend as we think about lifting the mask mandate. So every new milestone that we hit in our new normal will give us an idea of what we can expect going forward. So hopefully that will be continuing to build on the success we made.
Thank you. 1-800-423-8255 to ask your questions. I am going to turn to the phones in just a moment. But before I do, Dr. Durone, the CDC is now looking into a heart problem in a few young Pfizer vaccine recipients. Can you tell us what they're looking at and how serious that issue is? Does it affect our sense of the efficacy and safety of the Pfizer vaccine for kids?
Yeah. So, you know, this isn't actually new news. Israel was looking into this same issue earlier in their vaccination program. And, you know, I am encouraged that the CDC is being transparent about the fact that they're looking at it. I'm encouraged by the fact that they have made a clear statement that they do not see a signal that the rate of this heart inflammation in the vaccinated population is greater than the rate of that same condition in an unvaccinated population. And that's really the key question with any side effects or supposed side effects that people are reporting after vaccination. And we know, I might feel less encouraged if I didn't already know that with the J&J vaccine, the system picked up an extremely rare complication, those blood clots with low platelets that did appear to be associated with the vaccine, at a rate of, you know, 6 cases out of 7 million vaccines. And that was over and above the what we call the baseline rate or the underlying population rate of that condition. So while I am, you know, anxiously waiting for the result of their investigation, I feel pretty confident that they're going to find that, unfortunately, this condition does occur with some regular incidence in the population, even without vaccination.
All right, so let's turn to the phones now, 800-423-8255, to ask your question. We've got Natalie on the line in Cambridge. Natalie, what's your question for the doctors?
Hi, I got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in April, right before the pause. And after the CDC made their announcement last week that vaccinated people could go unmasked, I read the studies that they used to make their decision, and all of those studies seem to be on people who received Pfizer or Moderna. And I've tried to search for real-world data regarding Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and I can't find anything. So it seems clear to me that Johnson & Johnson's vaccine wasn't considered in their decision and that it's not as effective as Moderna or Pfizer. So my question is, can I go and get a shot of Pfizer or Moderna to supplement the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that I already received?
Thank you, Natalie. So, Dr. Pierre, let's take it in three pieces. Natalie asserts CDC didn't take Johnson & Johnson into account. It is less effective. Can I get a booster of one of the others? So maybe just briefly address all three pieces of that.
Sure. That's a great question, Natalie. So it is true that the decision made by the CDC to relax the mask mandate for vaccinated individuals took into account real-world studies on the mRNA vaccines because those were the first that had the EUA approval. And so we have the preponderance of information about real-world effects and events on populations in countries with these vaccines. We have less information to date with Johnson & Johnson. The information that you mention that establishes lower efficacy for Johnson & Johnson is pulled from different numbers that we see for effectiveness in reducing infection among individuals with Johnson & Johnson and between studies between the Pfizer and the Moderna. So we saw about 95% of efficacy in reducing COVID-19 infection in the mRNA vaccines and closer to about 70% in this country in prevention of COVID-19 for Johnson & Johnson. However, we've said before that these studies were done during different time periods where there was a higher level of variance of concern. These were different populations, and so they may not be as comparable as we think they may be in head-to-head studies.
I'm sorry, higher levels of variance of concern in play with the J&J study than with Moderna and Pfizer, correct?
That's correct. Thank you for clarifying that. There were more variants of concern in the populations being studied with the Johnson & Johnson studies than in the mRNA vaccine. So you had a little bit of a tailwind, you know, a little bit of an issue with the Johnson & Johnson and that, you know, you were evaluating the efficacy in populations that had higher numbers of variants of concerns. That all being said, we know that all of these vaccines are extremely good at preventing severe complications of COVID-19 and hospitalization and death. So that is a really important thing to consider. So I would say that, you know, it's always up to the individual in terms of when they feel ready to stop the mask at this point, given the CDC's and our state's mandates. But we have good information about the efficacy of Johnson & Johnson alone by itself. And so in answer to the third part of the question, can you get a booster with an mRNA vaccine? That is currently not a recommendation that we have by the CDC, by our state, and really no data to prove improving efficacy with those boosters. So I would say most places would not do that at this time. I understand that this leaves a little bit of limbo for people who have gotten the Johnson & Johnson, but we really do have good information about the efficacy of these vaccines, similar to the mRNA vaccines in preventing severe complications and death. And as Dr. DeRoe mentioned earlier, our drive is always to think about defanging the virus, and that's what these do.
Thank you for that. Let's go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. Sarah's in Scituate with a question. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. So I'm calling because I'm just concerned about the timing of removing the mask mandate. It seems counterintuitive to have people remove their masks on a holiday weekend. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've got the Moderna vaccine. I feel comfortable outdoors. Indoors, I know it's a choice. I can still wear it, but it just seems very strange to do it on a holiday weekend. So I'm sort of interested to get someone's take on that.
All right, let's go to you, Dr. DeRoe.
Well, I don't know, you know, certainly what the rationale was behind May 29th as a specific date. You know, I think that I hope that a lot of the holiday gatherings will actually be outdoors. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of focus right now on what is the right timing of removing mask mandates. And I think one of the failures of public health messaging has been not giving us any warning or necessarily any clear rationale for moving from one phase to another in terms of masking. I think it makes a lot of sense to plan to remove mask mandates based on something like percent vaccinated plus the rate of infection in the population plus perhaps the number of patients hospitalized in that population. Unfortunately, that wasn't laid out in advance, so May 29th sounds sort of like it came out of thin air. But I feel very, very good about the steep downward trajectory of cases in the community. And I feel like vaccinated people are certainly safe indoors doing really anything with or without a mask. And unvaccinated people are increasingly safer every day with our plummeting case numbers.
800-423-8255. We've got Cattell on the line in Arlington. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering when we would get more information on the longevity of the vaccine. Like, I
am really glad we have them. I got the Pfizer vaccine. I think that they're very effective. But I don't know if this is going to be a yearly process or even, you know, someone who got it in January versus someone who gets it now, you know, how long the protection lasts. Thanks.
Dr. Pierre, go ahead.
Yeah, so yes, an excellent question. Now, as we start to near, you know, for some of us, the 6-month mark post-vaccination, we certainly have information that shows we continue to have above 90% efficacy for individuals who have received the mRNA vaccines, at 6 months after over 90% efficacy. So that's pretty good. But there are increasing signs that there may need to be revaccination or a booster, rather, at 12 months after the initial vaccination. So we are having a little bit more information now that seems to suggest we will probably need to expect and anticipate a booster. We don't have conclusive evidence or recommendations at this point, so we all still need to stay tuned, but we at least have information to show these vaccines' efficacy is excellent and remains excellent 6 months after the initial vaccination. For more information, more duration data, we'll still have to, you know, stay tuned and take a listen.
Let's go to Arjun in Roxbury. Arjun, you are on with a question. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. So I was reading an article about vaccine efficacy, the mRNA vaccine. Dr. Fauci had stated that there was a question about whether you have antibodies if vaccines are necessary. And his response was that the vaccine, mRNA vaccine, will increase your antibody response up to 10 times. So that's a lot. And given that the body's resources to fight off viruses, bacteria, are finite, my question was, is that pathological response going to be a detriment to an immune system when a new variant or a different virus hits the wild? Will it be possible or more difficult for the body to fight off those viruses, given that it had focused so much of its immunology and its attention to that one strain or that variety of strains that the mRNA vaccines coded for?
Thanks, Arjun. So, Dr. Daron, does it use it all up and leave us maybe more exposed to other kinds of infections or strains of illness?
Yeah, no, the immune system is an amazing thing, and it can be exposed to so many different pathogens, and then, or a synthetic version of that pathogen, and then antibodies, but not just antibodies, memory T cells and memory B cells can come raging back to fight that pathogen. We also know that the virus in this case can look quite different and can be a variant and can still be neutralized by our immune system, even if it was exposed to, you know, wild type virus or, you know, the original sequence virus that was used to make the vaccine. I think there might have also been a piece of that question that was about people who had prior COVID and their antibody response, and you know, that's something that's been talked about a lot, is, you know, as a rationale for people with prior COVID having, you know, agreeing to be vaccinated, you know, part of it is that we do see that there is an increase in the antibody response after vaccination and people have had prior COVID, and perhaps an even more complete immunologic response or coverage for people who are vaccinated. And so that's one of the, you know, pieces of rationale for the CDC to make a recommendation for people with prior COVID to be vaccinated, although I think that does need further study to see if, you know, they should perhaps only have one dose of mRNA vaccine or if maybe it doesn't make a difference in the real world. So more on that.
So I do just want to note, one of our producers, Jamie Bologna, did pull an article. Dr. Fauci did say levels up to 10 times that of natural infection, but he did also remind us that those are laboratory data, not proven outside the clinic.
Exactly.
Let's try to pick up one more call here. We've got Donna on the line in Chelsea. Donna, go ahead.
Hi, I'm 65 years old, and I just received my second shingles shot. I have not been vaccinated with COVID by Moderna or Pfizer yet. What should be the longevity that I wait after my second shingles shot?
Good question. And Dr. Pierre, if you could answer that for in general, if you've had some other shot or vaccine, how long should you wait, shingles and others?
You know, I think this is kind of an evolving recommendation. We had previously recommended that individuals wait 14 days from the time of another vaccine to get vaccinated with COVID-19, or vice versa, waiting a certain period of time after receiving the COVID vaccine to get another vaccine to avoid any interactions, any concerns about side effects that may be attributable to one or both of the vaccines. So I would say, if you can and you're not, at risk, any particularly, which you shouldn't be if you live in the Commonwealth, there's not, our numbers are down and you have the time, we would say usually 2 weeks just to be sure. I think there's some compelling data that, if for people who are thinking about booster shots, for example, or we're thinking about people coming in and getting repeat vaccinations, limited exposures to healthcare settings, we might want to think about getting those at the same time to improve our ability to get people vaccinated. But I would say that, John, if you have the time and you can go back, and I highly recommend that you do, thank you for asking this question, 14 days is what we have been recommending in the perfect world.
All right. That is Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Shira Derone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
It's been 1 year since George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Graphic footage of his death resonated deeply here in the Commonwealth, sparking protests, driving forward police reform bills, challenging every community to confront a history of racism. A year later, stuttering progress and so much pain remains. Still, Boston NAACP President Tanisha Sullivan says she believes in the potential of the protests over the past year to create transformation.
Transform into public policy solutions that are designed to really root out systemic racism, and most importantly, I am hopeful that the public policy will turn into practice.
Marking 12 months since Floyd's murder, the Boston Globe's Janae Osterhelt penned a column that reflects that year back to us unflinchingly. It's pain, our journey, our failures, and what we have left to do. And we wanted to talk to her about it. Janae, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Janae, I appreciate you joining us. I was originally thinking maybe I should ask you to kind of summarize your column, but it almost seems like it takes every word you wrote to get the complexity of what you're trying to capture and of this past year. Tell us about your process of writing that column.
It really turned me inside out, to be honest. I've been covering BLM since its inception, and that's more than half my career now. And it really does chip away at your spirit to live it and also have to kind of write and process it in real time. And the idea that George Floyd was going to be memorialized in a way that is almost reflective, like that is trying to be MLK Day, that is really trying to like make him a martyr and paint him as a sacrificial lamb, was incredibly hard, especially because people were dying and being murdered before him, and people have been murdered since him. Someone was murdered the day of the trial, and many times since that verdict was announced. And it was just hurtful. I revisited W.E.B. Du Bois' Strivings of the Negro People, which was written, over 100 years ago and is still incredibly relevant today. And in that piece, he talks about the unasked question of our people, which is, what is it like to be a problem? And, he talks about the veil and double consciousness and just all the ways in which this country is determined to see us in such a way. And I kind of just felt my way through the writing.
What should we do instead of making George Floyd a martyr or turning this moment into another MLK Day?
I mean, I think it starts with recognizing that this is not MLK Day, and that he was not MLK. He was not a person risking their lives for civil rights in a movement. He, you know, MLK was assassinated and George Floyd was lynched, and they're both horrible things, but I think that we need to be able to talk about the killings of unarmed Black people by police officers and systemic racism without trying to, as Ron Harris so beautifully put it, you know, make him someone who's dying on a cross for our sins, because he is not. You know, we can't just move on, and we also can't sit up here and act like it's progress. Being, you know, are we really going to say that, you know, we had to, just the fact that we watched a man die that way so gratuitously over and over, you know, hundreds of times this last year. And that's what it took for people to just talk about racism. And the president can't even like wrap his mind around defunding the police. He's giving more money to police. You know, we have to be willing to admit that this country is trapped in its own supremacy and capitalism and just disgusting oppression, and stop looking for quick fixes and feel-good band-aids. And I think we love to do that. We love to have short memories and delight in short-term progress versus talking about dismantling a system and what it takes to reimagine and rebuild an actual free and equitable society.
You talked about how long you've been writing and reporting in this space, and you talked about the fact that it kind of turned you inside out to have to write this one. Was there, were there a moment where you thought, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to write about this anymore. I'm not going to, I can't. And if there was that moment, where did you find the strength to do it anyway?
Absolutely, there was a moment. There were several moments. It took me 10 days to write this piece, and not to write, but just 10 days of anxiety and just thinking and like thinking about that essay that, you know, Du Bois wrote over 100 years ago, and how it could still stand today, like it's still just as relevant. And having anxiety because I'm always worried about how my community will feel about what I'm saying and how I'm saying it. And I never want to let them down or just get it wrong. And, you know, we're all humans and sometimes we get it wrong. And, you know, I found the strength from my friend Christopher, actually. I was telling him, I don't think I can do this. And I was having a meltdown and he was like, you can do this. He was like, this is who you are. This is what you do. If you were called to do this, you stand in your light, you stand in your energy. And it kind of pushed me forward. And it, you know, he reminded me of what I created with A Beautiful Resistance, which was created after I went to George Floyd's funeral in Minneapolis.
It's your series, just for our listeners who may not know the series in the Boston Globe.
Yeah, it's a series celebrating Black life and Black joy, because I needed to offer something that showed us not dead, that showed us vibrant and alive and celebrated our joy and our expansiveness beyond brutalization. But yeah, his reminder, his call to action is what helped me find the strength to write the piece.
You talked a minute ago about, my words, not yours, not glossing over the murder of George Floyd in this moment. And you wrote in your essay, you wrote about a quote from Ron Harris, who's the chief resilience officer of Minneapolis, in which he says that the Derek Chauvin verdict essentially made white people feel, quote, like they were vindicated in that moment and relieved to move on, end quote. Your article challenges white America that we can't just move on, that was a moment, as we heard from the Attorney General in Minnesota, of accountability, but not justice.
Yeah, we cannot mistake this rare gasp of accountability for justice. It is not justice. Justice is us never having to fight for this stuff in the first place. We're literally fighting for basic human decency. Like, that's insane. There's nothing, there's no justice in that. Justice can never be served to that family or any of these families. Because justice would be these victims being alive. That would be justice. If you hear a crazy sound in the background, my dog has gotten a hold of one of her toys. But
I am pro canine in all interviews. So you just go right ahead.
But it's I understand why people want to move on. I do. And I understand why they want to celebrate when things like the Chauvin verdict happened. But we still don't know how many years he's going to get. You know, we don't, there's so many things we don't know. And we've seen how these things can go wrong in the past. And for me, it's like, we can't just gloss over the murder. We can't afford to accept the murder of George Floyd as an isolated event. And I think what Ron Harris was trying to get at is that a lot of people kind of, white people, but other people too, I think they kind of looked at that like this isolated moment. So they joined their book clubs and tried to read their way out of racism and got their participation ribbons for the protest. And then when he was found guilty, they were like, oh yay, we did it. We won racism. And it's like, no, we didn't win racism. This is still happening every day. And there's so many names you don't even know. And the fact that it wasn't until after George Floyd was murdered that we even talked about Breonna Taylor, who was murdered 2 months beforehand, is a travesty in itself. And it's something that we continue to see happen. You know, there are more trans people being murdered at disgustingly high numbers, and we just never even learn their names. They literally are living in their own violent epidemic that we refuse to even fight for or acknowledge. We are in so many different intersecting points of trauma and oppression that we just can't afford to look at these things as isolated events. Like, we have to fight for collective liberation.
I'm going to have to end us there. I will look forward to talking with you again soon, I hope. Boston Globe columnist Janae Osterholt, thanks for sharing with us today, and thanks for the article, for the piece.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, listeners. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.